Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello, and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Ray Parrish of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Bringing high-speed broadband to everyone in America would help get the economy back on track. And the Obama administration supports funding better broadband infrastructure. But the question remains, what should government investment actually look like? The New America Foundation's Wireless Future program released a paper called Building a 21st Century Broadband Superhighway that proposes one answer. Sasha Meinrath is the research director of the Wireless Future program and coordinates the Open Technology Initiative. He says our current system is a patchwork of infrastructure that doesn't serve everyone because broadband companies have focused on just the most lucrative markets.
What we've ended up with is a very unequally distributed internet system in the United States. And this is a problem. If we think about this coming era, this information age, this digital era that we are now just beginning, those communities that are left offline will suffer increasing problems because of the lack of service that they face.
Meinrath and the New America Foundation believe we need to think of broadband the same way we think of roads. The public pays for them, and anyone can have access to the infrastructure. Meinrath wants to build fiber optic conduits alongside America's roads.
The idea is that each time a road is ripped up or repaved or improved upon, that you lay fiber at that point in time.
Meinrath wants to tie his broadband superhighway proposal to the omnibus transportation bill that's expected to pass Congress this year.
When you lay down about 1 mile of road, it often costs about $2.5 million. Once you've dug these roads up, the cost of laying down fiber tends to be around $5,000 to $15,000. So you're talking about a tiny fraction of 1% of the cost of this transportation infrastructure. Fiber infrastructure probably costs about the same as laying down the markings on lanes on roads. It's an incredibly efficient use of funding that brings a huge economic activity and benefits to the communities that it would serve.
For more information about the broadband superhighway, go to newamerica.net.
Cut and paste, remix, mashup. All these terms are part of the digital media lexicon, but in the music world, there's an older and more familiar phrase that describes borrowing sounds from another artist. Sampling. Kembru McLeod and Benjamin Franzen are the co-producers of Copyright Criminals, This is a Sampling Sport, a documentary on the controversies surrounding copyright, intellectual property, and music. McLeod says the film focuses on the story of hip-hop sampling in particular, a place where new musical styles directly collided with copyright law itself nearly two decades ago.
The reason why it's important to focus on hip-hop when telling the story of these copyright controversies is because it really shows what's at stake. Because hip-hop basically ran into a kind of creative wall about 18 years ago when artists started getting sued. And that was really detrimental to this really important African-American art form.
The intersection of musical style and copyright law may not seem immediately apparent, but the effects of such restrictive legal practices has a direct impact on culture itself.
Let's think back to soul music or jazz, both of which relied heavily on musical borrowing. Imagine if when Ray Charles was about to rewrite that gospel song and turn it into his first big hit, some intellectual property lawyer tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Nope, you can't do that." Or imagine jazz soloists being stopped, you know, John Coltrane, from riffing on a Broadway melody. And that didn't happen back then, and the art was able to evolve. And the same thing wasn't true of hip-hop. And so, in other words, we can look to the relatively recent past to see what the detrimental effects of overzealous copyright protection are.
The 2004 Supreme Court case, Bridgeport Music versus Dimension Films, laid down the law explicitly on sampling, stating bluntly, get a license or do not sample. We do not see this as stifling creativity in any significant way. As a result, McLeod says, a lot of sampling has just gone back underground.
So you're either within the law and you can pay for the law, basically, or you're a complete outlaw. And that really kind of stopped the evolution of sampling. Basically, by the early 1990s, hip-hop artists had to start paying for every little fragment of sound. It became impossible for them to economically and legally afford to be able to make the art the way they wanted to.
The film will be released this spring. For more information, visit copyrightcriminals.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The election of Michael Steele, a black man, as chairman of the Republican National Committee, is viewed by many as an additional proof that America is becoming less racist. If one measures racism entirely by headcount, that is, by the number of blacks or other minorities represented in places of power or prominence, then one would conclude that racism is now a dead issue in the two major U.S. political parties. American politics can at long last be declared a racism-free zone, right? Wrong. In the real America, the ascension of Michael Steele to the GOP chairmanship on the heels of Barack Obama's presidential victory proves only that we have arrived at the end of the road of a politics that is consumed in promotion of black faces to positions in high places. There is no place further to go. A black man heads the party in power and the major party that is temporarily out of power. If that's all the centuries of black struggle was about, to place a few dark-skinned individuals at the highest position of party and government, then black folks should do as Professor Francis Fukuyama suggested 20 years ago and declare the end of history, the end of black history, that is. But of course, black history is not over. What needs to end is the foolish mode of thought that equates individual black victories with progress for the race as a whole, an assumption that has led to today's state of mass black political confusion. Many, if not most, African Americans have lost sight entirely of the issues that define the lives and fortunes of their families. They thought they had their eyes on the prize, but were really just fixated on a single personality, Barack Obama, a man who never promised much in the first place and will certainly deliver far less. If one believes that Obama represents the ultimate black victory, then Michael Steele's capture of the Republican National Committee chairmanship must be rated as at least a significant advance for African Americans, right? Well, that depends on what you mean. The Republicans remain the white man's party. They have simply become more polite in their race relations, as have white Americans in general. The suppression of overt expressions of white racism is a bona fide victory achieved over the last 40 years. Whites now accept the inclusion of certain acceptable blacks as players in their political games. Michael Steele's individual good fortune may owe something to Barack Obama's singular victory. But then, Obama may owe something to the Republicans for elevating Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice to previously unheard-of heights, which conditioned the white public to seeing black faces in high places. In that sense, why not give Clarence Thomas his due? In nominating Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court, George Bush the Elder was acknowledging that the retiring Thurgood Marshall's seat should be filled by another black person. By blacks in high places standards, this was a black victory, despite the fact that Clarence Thomas became black folks' worst enemy on the high court. the Republican National Committee decided not to elect black former Ohio Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, who was an early candidate for chairman. Blackwell single-handedly denied many thousands of blacks the right to vote in 2004. Would his victory have been an example of black progress? By the standards of black faces in high places, yes, as much a victory as Michael Steele's. The lesson here is, be careful what you celebrate. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stjepanchik. We now feature an interview with Ray Parrish of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. The following interview was recorded on Friday, February 6th, 2009. We are joined on the phone with Ray Parrish. Ray Parrish is a member of VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He is also a military and veterans counselor for VVAW. He himself had been a non-commissioned officer along with his parents with the U.S. Air Force. And Ray is joining us on the phone from Chicago.
That's correct. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you very much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about VVAW for folks who might be unfamiliar with the group.
Certainly. It was started in 1967 while the war was still going on. And over the years, its focus on anti-war activities was equaled by its focus on veterans' rights, especially by on something that back then was called the Vietnam Syndrome. Now, we know that that was a combination of Agent Orange exposure and post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was through the efforts of VVAW's literally unceasing advocacy that things happened and that veterans' benefits and treatment for both environmental toxins, as they are now called, and for post-traumatic stress disorder has changed dramatically in the past 40 years. So now our young vets are coming back to something anyway.
And no doubt the work with regards to VVAW continues, especially in regards to the current situation involved with military, and in particular military recruitment. Is that correct?
Well, VVAW as a whole tends to focus our veterans and military counseling on those that other people aren't paying attention to. The literal slogan for our office is leave no vet behind. And so if somebody tells me they're able to take care of 95% or 98% of the problem, I'm there for that 2%.
And that includes matters with regards to counseling and support?
Oh, definitely. Because of my my lifetime experience with the military and working as a veteran service officer for the American Legion and as a mental health rehabilitation caseworker on the streets of Chicago, people can talk to me about just about anything, and I'll have an answer or a direction or I'll get back to you when I do find an answer.
Very cool. There are a couple of topics that were brought to my attention which I'd like to discuss with you with regards to the military. One has to do with that of a matter involved with contemporary military recruitment, and also the possibility that this may be in violation of an international law that the United States is a party to. Can you tell us more about this?
Sure, yeah. The basic issue with military recruitment is viewed differently depending upon your own, well, quite literally, your own political perspective. So a lot of people are literally opposed to any and all military recruitment. And what they do is they point to Article 1 of a UN convention signed by the United States back in 2002. It was during the Bush administration. And it's from the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights, and it's the Convention on the Rights of the Child on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict. So that's the full name of it. And so basically what it does is Article 1, after going through a long list of reasons why children under the age of 18 are especially susceptible to propagandizing and manipulation and misuse, after a litany of the problems facing the world when it comes to this issue of children in armed conflict, Article 1 says, state party shall take all feasible measures to ensure that members of their armed forces who have not attained the age of 18 do not take part in hostilities. Okay, so this is Article 1. This is the primary goal, is that everybody, all of the state parties, should adhere to Article 1. And then after that, there's 18 other articles. And it gets down to Article 3, where it says that parties that permit voluntary recruitment into their national armed forces under the age of 18 shall maintain safeguards to ensure, at a minimum, that such recruitment is genuinely voluntary, that such recruitment is carried out with the informed consent of the person's parents, plural, or legal guardians, and that such persons are fully informed of the duties involved in such military persons. And, you know, so this is the loophole that the United States government and quite literally all the other governments are using and saying, well, we're party to Article 3 because we do allow recruitment of under 18, but we don't allow them into hostilities until their 18th birthday.
And so,
okay, this
right.
is the rules and regulations of the U.S. government in their recruiting manuals, is that, yes, we'll, if your parents or guardians sign you up and you're 17 years old and you really want to go, they'll take you in, they'll train you, and they'll put you through training until you turn 18, and then they'll send you into hostilities, and they have not violated this convention. Okay?
Right. Okay.
I want to make clear that the whole idea about military recruitment is more than just whether or not we're fulfilling this convention. It's the whole idea of recruitment of people under 18 because of their susceptibility to military recruitment. And that's why you see now that the military is literally pulling out all the plugs with multi-million dollar installations in malls where video games are wall to wall. It's literally acres of video games and combat simulators so that young people can go in there and get their rocks off and really kill things. And then they're recruited into the military because then they get to feel the rock and roll of a real weapon on full automatic. And that's the start of the adrenaline addiction. So it's that adrenaline addiction of combat soldiers who have spent, you know, 9, 12, 15 months in combat, not sleeping, up on edge, probably drugged to the gills with sleep aids or antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications. Some even take anti-seizure medications because their stress is so bad it's actually causing them seizures, which of course is related to the traumatic brain injury. You know, the idea of getting blown up all the time, you're not taking shrapnel, you're just getting repeated concussions. So this is another hidden phenomena that's going on among veterans. And this is related to counter-recruiting because to fully inform a young 18 or 17-year-old, you really need to get into these things, and so many recruiters cannot. And I say they cannot because a lot of them want to. A lot of them want to be fully open, but they cannot do that and sell recruitment so they don't do it. And that leads a lot of recruiters to suicide. There's been a phenomena in Army recruiting. They actually did a one-day stand-down of every Army recruiter in the country. None of them were doing recruiting duty for that one day. They were all going through re-education training about suicide prevention and depression and anxiety and trying to make those damn quotas, trying to get everybody they can in, looking for waivers, begging their officers for these waivers for recruitment. And so the whole idea of military recruiting is hurting the recruiters. It's whenever I go into a class and if they want to have me debate a recruiter, the first thing I do is I give the recruiter my card. Because that's my primary purpose, is being there for that recruiter. My dad was a recruiter, Air Force recruiter, from 60 to 65. And the records he set in 64 still stand as the best recruiter of any armed forces. And I used to do volunteer work, you know, stamping his literature. I'd be taking these mass-produced, glossy pieces of literature and stamping his name and address and phone number on them, so he could give out to the students. And he always had made his quota for, you know, years. So the whole idea is a lot of things change over time and a lot don't. A lot of us are looking at the new administration as being able to inspire people to voluntary service, with the knowledge that the foreign policy will change such that your worries about being involved in hostilities at any age can melt away. But that's just not going to happen, not in the near future. We're going to be involved with the wars. So recruitment really does mean that people who are doing what's called counter-recruiting must be allowed to come in and talk to young people about their point of view, the idea of conscientious objection, because that's the whole essence of so much of the PTSD that these young people coming back from deployments are dealing with, is that PTSD is not a solely psychological condition. These people have had their souls injured. This is a spiritual injury. And if they can address that, then they can make it through recovery. But not being able to find that spiritual home, that touchstone that gives them the feeling of being back, without that, they're going to be lost.
Mm-hmm. Very well put. The second matter I'd like to discuss with regards to the military has to do with the, I guess you could call a systemic sexism with regards to the military. Ostensibly, women are, and within recent years and decades, have been able to join in the military service if they so choose. But yet you're finding instances of systemic sexism, rape, violations of some sort. I remember reading an article in the magazine In These Times by Jessica Popovac, who had investigated some of the more egregious instances of I guess sexual harassment by male officers upon female officers within the military. Can you describe this phenomenon?
Yes. The basic thing is to remember that we're dealing with an army in combat that's, you know, overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly being affected by raging hormones of teenagers at that age. So we've got testosterone poisoning going on among our male troops over there, and we have to acknowledge that and the fact that they are on an adrenaline high, that they are being sleep deprived merely by the fact that they are where they are, and if they are not on alert 24/7, they may not survive to make it back. So they do whatever they need to do to survive and come home, if there's something for them to come home to. And that's one of the reasons why there's such a high suicide rate, is that a lot of soldiers are seeing that what they're coming home to is nothing. Now, part of this is quite literally the most severe PTSD people are on their multiple deployments. So they have done this before. They have been through a deployment. They have come home, seen whatever it was they saw that made them go back for their second deployment and third deployment, etc. So the more deployments there are, the more exposure to these traumatic events. So the more buddies you lose, the more people you kill, the more more times your brain gets knocked around inside your helmet. So the most severe disorders coming back are almost always unable to control themselves. And so that's where a lot of the dismissive attitude among GIs come in. Most of the men who have been convicted of rape and interviewed afterwards in the military have all said that they never imagined in a million years when they joined the military that they ever would have done that. Okay, this is one of those phenomena that is a product of being involved in hostilities, as the convention says. And that's because you need a certain amount of experience and education and sophistication to endure this. My father went through World War II and two tours in Vietnam, and the difference in how he reacted as a young 17-year-old in 1945 was a lot different than when he was 40 years old in Vietnam in 1968. And so the issues that are involved with rape in the military, it's depends on where and when you served. The closer you get to combat, the more common it is. The rates are different if you're from a National Guard unit versus an active duty unit. Men and women who go through active duty training for multiple years become literally intimate with each other in ways that only other veterans can understand. And there's no sex involved. It's just that feeling of comradeship that we all used to call brotherhood. But I think we need to change our lingo to take into account the fact that the number of women who are out there kicking in doors in the Lioness Brigade, as they're called, has things to teach us. And that is that women should not be disrespected by treating them the way that a rapist treats their victims. And the survivors of all of this trauma, whether it's from combat or from, as they euphemistically call it now, military sexual trauma, MST, that the post-traumatic stress disorder from either one of those is recognized by the VA as equally devastating and equally deserving of treatment and appropriate treatment and compensation.
Certainly true. One last personal question in the 3 minutes or so that we have remaining. Clearly, you've been speaking very critically with regards to the military, and yet you yourself have a military background, not only as having served, but having come from a family whose parents served. At least from my naive ear, this sounds like there's something of a disconnect here. What kind of, could you explain a little bit about the history about how someone who's been so critical about the military apparatus and military recruitment and a lot of military things was able to emerge from someone whose background was so military?
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I'll be glad to tell you the short version. After my dad returned from Vietnam, we moved to Japan, where I went through the last 2.5 years of high school and graduated, and I worked full-time for the last 2 years. I was there in a warehouse, and I was the only dependent among a group of veterans, most of whom were Vietnam vets. So I quite literally grew up among Vietnam vets, telling me the reality of life on the lines. No matter where the lines were, these guys had been well-traveled. And when I heard from my lifer father, when I was reading in the mainstream media, there was the disconnect I found. I didn't see the reality I was hearing from the eyewitnesses reflected in what I was reading. Now, I was the high school newspaper editor for the last 2 years I was there. And so, you know, I was fairly up to date and fairly critical of stuff like this. And it opened my eyes to the fact that no matter who you are, no matter how good you are at whatever job you choose, even if you're the best SEAL, when that bullet comes, it comes. And that's it. And so the thing is, you're often on the side that has to pull the trigger. And that means that you're going to have to take the life of another human being to survive. And nobody, I repeat, nobody should ever have to be put in that position, because it's going to stay with them for the rest of their lives.
We've been speaking with Ray Parrish. He is a member of VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, who also works as a military and veterans counselor. He himself is of a military background, having served in the U.S. Air Force as an NCO, and whose parents were also Air Force NCOs. And Ray Parrish, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. Good luck with everything else.
That was an interview with Ray Parrish of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, recorded on February 6, 2009. To learn more about Vietnam Veterans Against the War, go online to www.vvaw.org for Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.